Let's have a few moments of silence and then we'll do the serenity prayer.
God,
grant me serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference.
Amen. Yeah. I'm Tarek. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous.
Hey, Tarek.
How many alcoholics do we have in here that have very little drug experience? I'm just curious. Alcoholics with little drug experience. All right. How many drug addicts we got in here?
A lot.
All right. I was talking to a new friend outside. We were talking about this idea of a higher power and like belief in this higher power. You know, and some of us come here and we've never had any beliefs about God. Not opposed to it, just never gave it any real thought. And then some of us who grew up religious or spiritual believe that God failed us at some point, and we don't think we can recapture that faith. And then we have the belligerent ones, which are the ones who just flat out say, "They're no, I'm not going to buy into it. I'm going to live on self-propulsion, and I'm going to use my own self-sufficiency to get by." And you know, one of the definitions of humility that I've been working with here is anything that distances me from self-sufficiency. The further I can go from self-sufficiency, the closer I'm drifting towards some type of humility. Right. But what stops at self-sufficiency is God's sufficiency. But the crazy thing in here is like we talk about freedom from alcohol and drugs, and the freedom from alcohol and drugs then opens us up to being a slave to something else, because the big book says alcohol was our master. We'd met our match. You know, quicksand stretched in all directions. I was sinking, you know, and I had to throw up my hands and admit that alcohol and crack cocaine were my masters. But then I get sober and I say I'm free, but then I become a slave to my character defects. And that's literally how it's been for me. You know, I write down these little things when I'm at conferences or sometimes in my home group. I got this little book and I hear something that just moves me. And I heard this, and you know, for me to say when I stop drinking and using, I get worse. Because don't we hear that in the meeting sometimes? I put down the drugs. That disrespects where I came from. And I forget what the hell and death were like that I was experiencing with drugs and alcohol. So the longer I stay sober, the more imperative it is that I remember from where I came. So where is it that, you know, that I came from? You know, what has catapulted me into a desire to build a relationship with a God of my misunderstanding? You know, like many people, who in here grew up in an alcoholic home? Yeah, man, that's like half the room. You know, you remember that, right? I don't know what it was like for you, but what it was like for me was screaming in the middle of the night, furniture breaking in the middle of the night, door slamming shut in the middle of the night, dad coming home from work. He's fine when he walks in the door. Then a couple hours behind a closed door, he comes out and he's a different person and the house is on eggshells and he's throwing shit and he's yelling at people. Then he gets physically abusive with my mom and my grandmother. And as we get older, me and my brother have to get him off of my mom, and then we actually get in physical altercations with him. You know? And then growing up, this little kid, right, says to himself, there's something bad in that bottle. When he drinks that bottle, something bad happens. I'm not going to be like my dad, right? But I'm an uneasy kid. There's something just like a spring in my chest that tightens. I'm hypersensitive. I'm dissatisfied a lot of the time. There's always some place to get to, right? I'm never okay where I'm at. I got to go somewhere else. And then I'm easily annoyed. Does that sound familiar? I'm easily annoyed by people and situations in life. But yet this kid, right, he said, I'm not going to drink. I ain't going to end up like my dad. Except when this kid's 14 years old, he thinks the world is not a very pleasant place. The world just didn't wasn't a nice place for me. I don't know how it was for you. As some of you have introduced yourselves to me, I have introduced myself to you. And I said, Tarek. And a lot of people get my name wrong, right? It's not a Southern name, if you haven't noticed. it's a Middle Eastern name. You know, I was born in another country. My family immigrated to this country when I was 3 years old. We moved to Atlanta, Georgia in like 1980, 81. And so I'm in the Deep South, and I'm getting introduced to my friends, and the parents are doing a double take because they see me. I don't look like my name. And so I don't fit in. So a common theme with a lot of alcoholics and addicts when they tell their stories is like they didn't fit in, right? But here's the trippy part, right? So my parents, I grew up in a Muslim home, but my parents were not very religious. My mom was working. I think after all these years, she worked her 60 hours a week so she wouldn't have to be home with my dad, right? Because she knew what was going to happen when she was home. But she had to support the family because dad was a drunk, right? And so she knew she wasn't religious, but she thought it'd be a good idea to send me and my brother to the mosque, right? And you send these two redhead boys who have now been westernized to the mosque. What happens to them? They get ostracized. They don't fit in, right? So I go back home, and I want to be a part of Bible study. I want to hang out with my friends. So I go to Bible study, but I don't fit in there. I'm ostracized in both places, right? And so then you throw in being sexually abused by a family member, okay, for 3 years, off and on. And so now this kid starts to think there's really something wrong with him, right? And he begins to play sports. And he finds an identity with sports. He's pretty good at sports. And then, like, a basketball coach takes interest in him. And I find out I'm really good at basketball, and I play all year round. I play AAU. I end up playing my first year in college. You know, but then around 1995, I get introduced to the music of the Grateful Dead, Widespread Panic, and Phish. Okay, and so this whole time, you know, I'm being indoctrinated into this underground culture, and I get introduced to this idea that if you travel around the country selling drugs in these parking lots, you can get into the show for free. You'll have all the drugs you can do and alcohol you can drink for free. And you'll always have women talking to you if you have a pocket full of drugs. And so I just jumped all over that lifestyle, man. So between 1996, when I first started, and 2007, when I got sober, I spent the majority of that time driving around this country, following these bands around, sleeping in hotels, you know, getting jobs here and there, finishing college after 5 years, you know, ripping my parents off with a bunch of money. They thought I was in grad school when I got kicked out, but I was getting all this money. So I just went ahead and lied for a couple of years that I was actually getting a master's degree when I wasn't. You know, things I'd have to make amends for later on. But looking back on it, what, anybody here been to those concerts? Anybody here been to a Panic show or a Phish show? Or, yeah. And so when you're getting high at these concerts, it's like you're looking for this magical combination of drugs and alcohol, and then you have like human connection at an exponential level. And for those 3 to 4 hours, if you count like hanging out in the parking lot before and after, you don't have a past, you don't have a future, you're entirely present to your life. That is called freedom from the bondage of self. I didn't know that until I got sober and I worked the steps looking back. That's why I chased that. Because I spent all my life was lived here. It was never lived here unless I was there. And so eventually I started getting some consequences. And there's a part of the steps you can't work. You know, you can sit down with your sponsor and go through the doctor's opinion and Bill's story. There is a solution, more about alcoholism. We agnostics, and you can work the first step, right? To that, the first page of We Agnostics. You know, if when you honestly want to, you find you can't quit entirely. And if one drink and you can't control the amount you drink, you're probably an alcoholic, all right? And if it applies to drugs, then you're probably a drug addict. That you can work that part of the first step, the powerlessness piece. But the part of the first step you can't work is this thing called surrender. I didn't surrender to drugs and alcohol. I was surrendered. So it took a set of circumstances for that to take place. I went to my first 12-step meeting in September of 2004. And I swear to you, I thought it was a cult. Okay? I really thought this place was a cult. They did a lot of chanting at this specific meeting. I don't know why we do that. I get the young people want to make it fun. I get the idea behind it. But if I was brand new in a meeting and they were chanting along with all the readings and they chant like specific things and they do it in unison, I'm tripped out. Right? I'm already tweaking to begin with, and now I'm like, no. So like I didn't want anything anybody in that room had, right? Which I'm still crazy that they tell you to go find somebody that has what you want, but you don't know what anybody has. How does that happen? And so I go to meetings off and on. I started selling large quantities of drugs. And this is just part of my story. I'm not trying to like describe it in such a way that makes me seem cooler. It's just part of my story. And we were moving heavyweight and I got arrested and I had two drug trafficking charges. And I was in Florida at a panic show and they arrested me. And that, the way I look at it is, you know, God, the hand of God is all over our lives. I can't tell you the number of trap houses and crack houses I was in where I felt something protected me that just pushed me out of the house at the right time. Or I was in a crack house tweaking out, but the guy that I would cop from, I was his boy. And he would say, you know, that's Terrell's boy. Don't mess with him. Right. And you know me, I'm the tweaker who whispers and who's bug-eyed, right? So I make other crackheads very uncomfortable when I'm and so I typically wouldn't talk about this stuff, but since everybody in the room raised their hands and said they're addicts, I figure everybody's comfortable with it. But and so God, on the evening of November 4th in 2007, dressed up like a bunch of cops. He put on the badge. All right, that was God coming into my life. And it wasn't, I don't see it as the grace. People talk about grace all the time. Now, grace is divine intervention in the assistance of a human being. That's one definition of it, right? Unmerited divine assistance. The definition of mercy is the compassionate treatment bestowed upon a human being in distress. Which one do you think happened to me? I like to say it was mercy because I didn't deserve what happened to me. Right, I get what grace is. I know I experienced grace as well, but mercy is what got me into this program, this fellowship, God's mercy. And so I get arrested that night and I stay up all night. And at this point, I'm doing 280 milligram OCs a day. There's this chemical called DMT that I'm smoking. I'm smoking a bunch of crack. I'm drinking ungodly amounts of alcohol. And I'm gonna go into some type of detox, right? So the first night was rough. For all I know, this could have been a hallucination. Let's be real, man. Who knows what happened to Bill Wilson in that town's hospital in December of 1934? You know, back then when you had the DTs, it was a brutal, brutal experience, right? And they had you on all kinds of medications and barbiturates, and they're trying to wean you off, and they're binging you and purging you. And I'm willing to bet you might have some visions and hallucinations. But here's the thing. God doesn't just work through sober people. You can be full-on high, drunk, and have a spiritual experience. It is possible. The way I like to think about it is Bill had an experience that was the Big Bang. That spiritual awakening in Towns Hospital, man. He was depressed. He was angry. And he said, God, show yourself to me. And the room lit up and he felt this nice, nice, cool breeze come in. And he had been contacted so deeply that he had the most intense desire in the world to save every alcoholic on the planet. It just blows my mind every time. I mean, my hair is standing up just telling this story. And so I sit in this jail and I'm watching the sun come up. It's Duval County Jail in Jacksonville, Florida. And I'm still under the influence. And see, something had happened 5 years before this. On November 5th in 2003, one of my best friends overdosed and died. And a little part of me died when Jason died. And And so here I am sitting at the edge of this cot in this cell watching the sun come up. And I realize there's a real, the way I use these words, I use them always the same way. This realization was injected into my consciousness. The realization was that today was my new sobriety date, and it was Jason's birthday. All right. So Jason had passed away on my birthday in 2003, and here I am being destroyed, killed, taken to the gates of insanity and almost death on the morning, November 5th, and God plucks me back. Whatever God is, plucks me back. Because he gives my new sobriety date a very significant meaning for me. And that was the realization in that moment. What's crazy is like the voice of the liar. Everybody in this room sitting here tonight has a little voice that's lying to you about something going on in your life. 100% guilty. It's happening right now. And this voice gets really loud in a lot of our heads. And it forces us out those doors from this fellowship and this program. It does it all the time. I've been watching it for 18 years. And whatever that is had gone into remission. That's part of the surrender that we can't work. I didn't do anything to bring that about. The voice just wasn't there. And as I sat in this jail, I was on the second floor when that experience happened, right? They hadn't processed all my charges, right? At this point, I've been arrested with these quantities of drugs. Once they find out I have two Schedule I trafficking charges, they have to move me up to the fifth floor in the jail. And that's when it gets really interesting, right? Because you're no longer in the section with the misdemeanors and the DUIs. You're now in the section with the rapists and the murderers and all that stuff. So I went from this little pod to this pod with 72 men in it. And it was a scary place, I'm not going to lie. So I get into my cell. And every time I'm leaving for one of the chow lines, I am having a verbal altercation with somebody. Because one thing I knew is that you try not to make eye contact, but you don't back down. That's all I knew going into this situation. And people are messing with me every time I'm going to get my tray. And I'm sitting in my cell, but I'm watching like a couple times during the day, there's a group of men that walk over to the pods, into the pod. There's like a little nook like there is right there where those two doors are. And they had books. And so I started to like make my way off the tier, and I would walk over and I curled up in a ball in the corner, and they were doing a Bible study. And they talked about things I heard you fine people in Alcoholics Anonymous talk about. They talked about concepts like gratitude and restitution. They talked about surrender. They talked about service, all things that I had heard in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so it was almost as if whatever this entity is that we call God was communicating. It was saying, go back to AA. Go back to the 12 steps. And so I'm sitting in there, and they pass these books around the pod. And these books, two of them, I still remember them to this day. One book was called Exceeding Gratitude for the Creator, and this other book called Live Your Best Life Now. Both books have sections that refer to the 12-step fellowships in them. And I'm like, I can't ignore it. And the voice of the liar is in remission. There's no voice talking Tarek out of this. And so I sit there, and I don't know what week it was. I was in there for 5 weeks. I had gone to this CA meeting on Friday nights in Atlanta, man. It was a really large CA meeting. It was in an auditorium. And there was this bald guy. At the time, I was like 31. Well, now I was in my late 20s at this time. So he was probably in his mid-40s at this time. I just thought he was an old geezer, right? He sat on the back row, and they closed with him every meeting. Every meeting, this man would be the last one that shared. And this is what he would say. It sounded like this. I don't know if this is what he said, but this is what I remember. If you're new, welcome. But you've got absolutely nothing that we want. But we encourage you. We beg you. Find a sponsor. Find a home group. Work these steps. Start making amends. Start working with others. Then come back and tell us all about that experience, right? And I remember this man's name was Dante. And we would go outside, you know, in our little treatment center. You know, the treatment center bubble that we all walk in here? It's a hard bubble to pierce, guys. It really is, okay? And I don't have enough time because there's a whole tangent I was about to go off on. I'm going to pull myself back in. And so we would go outside and assassinate this man's character. We literally would, man. Because at the treatment center, what we were being told that the meeting was our spiritual filling station, right? that we needed to go to the meeting and talk about our problems and get every single thing we could out of the meeting and then try to get to the next day so we could get to another meeting. This was my interpretation of what I heard about meeting attendance. And so I didn't like this man. I went to big book studies at this man's house. I went to his 4th of July party before I got sober at this man's house. And I just felt like I was on the outside of life looking in. Didn't feel like I belonged. Just didn't. They say welcome home when you walk through those doors. It has to feel like home. It didn't then. I've later found out there's rites of passage that we have here, one of which is working the steps. Specifically like a 5th step and a 9th step for me are rites of passage. And so this man who I just told you about, who I did not just speak fondly about, is in my head while I'm in Duval County Jail. And I get the thought that if I go back and find this man, that's the answer to my problems. And I'm telling you, I'm like in Fred's story. Well, what does he say in Fred's story? I don't want to botch it, man, but it's such a like revealing, like this is what I experienced. So in Fred's story at the bottom, he says, "But the moment I made up my mind to go through the process, I had the curious feeling my alcoholic condition was relieved, as in fact it proved to be. The moment I made up my mind that I was going to find Dante, I, for some reason, knew my problem had been solved." I can't tell you where that comes from other than this merciful God that I'm talking about. And so I have to have my arraignment. This is like the breaking point for me. This is like where I get split wide open. This is the turning point with the genuine surrender, I think. A lot of it, you could have pinpointed any one of those things as maybe the surrender, or maybe it's the entire experience itself. And they take me to the arraignment. They handcuff me at my wrist. They handcuff me at my ankles, and they truck me across the street to the courthouse, shackled to another group of men. They truck us into the courtroom, and they had us all sequestered in this one little section, and our lawyers could come talk to us. So one of the guys that I sold drugs with got me a lawyer. You know, when I called home, nobody wanted to talk to me. The best thing my family ever did for me was say, "No, you belong in jail." My brother did it. My best friend did it. My parents are these foreigners from another country. Bust their heart. They didn't know what to do with me, right? My dad wasn't really in the picture. He's still drunk at this point. I'll get to him tomorrow, but they take us into this courtroom, and this attorney walks over to me. And I'm going to tell you that the hand of God is all over this. I don't know how my buddy got me this lawyer, but my lawyer had been a cop. He was a assistant district attorney, and now he was a defense attorney. That has the hand of God written all over it, that I end up with this guy to represent me. So this guy walks over to me, and I said, "Hey, Travis, have you spoken to my mom?" Because I don't know about you, but I'm the type of alcoholic and addict that vanishes. When I go on a run, I go on a run. And I disappear, and I don't pick up my phone unless it's to get something or go somewhere to get something. That's the reason I'm picking up a phone. So, you know, my mom hadn't heard from me in quite some time when she got the phone call from jail. And so I said, "Have you seen my mom?" He goes, "Yeah, she's right there in the gallery." And so as I turned to face my mom, everything slowed down. You guys have those moments in your life where, like, they just seem a little different, you know? My vision was distorted. It seemed like everything dimmed out. There's this whole line of sight between me and my mom, and we connected. And what I witnessed was a frail woman with her eyes sunk in her head who looked like she was starving herself, and her knees buckled in the courtroom. And for the first time in my life, there was a lie that got smashed. This whole time, Tarek's not hurting anybody but Tarek. Just leave me the F alone. And that lie was smashed because I got to witness with my own eyes what my selfishness and my self-centeredness and my inconsideration does to other people. Notice I left out drugs and alcohol because I can hurt people stone cold sober. And something died in that moment, and something was raised from the scrap heap. Something was raised from the scrap heap. I was reborn. In that moment, I was reborn. Something was different. It was unacceptable to be capable of doing something like that to someone that cares about you. Not acceptance. Acceptance is the answer to some of our problems, not all of them. In that moment, for me, unacceptance was the answer. It was unacceptable. And from that unacceptance, I became willing to take a course of action I'd never been willing to take before. And so eventually, they let me out of that place. They sent me to this treatment center that was about 35, 40 minutes north of Atlanta And I got there on a Tuesday or Wednesday, and this whole time I need to find this guy, right? This guy, Dante. I keep telling him, you got to take me back to this specific meeting at Sandy Springs Church because there's somebody I need to find. Like, literally, where does that direction come from? Where does it come from? And so I go, and I finally work over the overnight staff for Friday night, and they take us all to this meeting in the druggy buggy. And we get to the church, and it's raining. It's like out of a movie, right? It's raining. We're late getting to the church. The meeting's already started. The van door opens, and I book it to the church, and there's one guy outside the church. And it's a guy, I'd gone to his house for a big book study. He was sponsored by the guy that I was being drawn to. I knew if I connected with this guy, it was going to get me to this guy. And so I walked up to this guy, Randy, and I said, man, please help me. I don't want to die living this way. Please help me. I'll do whatever you want. And that man started coming to the treatment center, and then he took me to Dante's house on Monday nights. And then I was doing this other big book study on Tuesday nights. And Randy came to my house, and to the treatment center, and every week he'd come, and it didn't matter. We did the forwards, the preface and the forwards in the first meeting, right? Then we did the doctor's opinion. Then we did Bill's story. Then we did There's a Solution. Then it's more about alcoholism. Then it's We Agnostics. But the part that really got me is when we got to the third step, guys. In the third step, we went into a storage closet in the basement of the treatment center that was packed with stuff, and we moved some stuff, and I got down on my knees, and I held hands with another man. And from the world I came from, you don't get down on your knees with a man in a closet. And that's what we did. And I got on my knees, held hands, and we read the third step prayer out of the book. And something that's hopped out at me off these pages, I swear, my buddy Charlie used to say that sometimes he'd read his big book and he'd find a word where the ink was still wet, right? And I swear a couple years ago on page 63, I found a wet word. And I'm sitting there, and I read my big book a lot. And it says on page 63, it says, when we sincerely took such a position, all sorts of remarkable things followed. What I did in that closet was sincere. I had no idea what it meant to work a third step other than I was going to work the rest of the steps. But there was something sincere in that. My heart was present to what I was doing, and I had knowledge about why I was doing it. And so I took that third step. I started writing inventory. I took a fifth step, and I took a 6 and 7 in my hour returning home, and I started making amends. And I'm going to get to this over the course of the weekend, some of the stories that are embedded in that experience. And I started making these amends, and I started sponsoring people. I started sponsoring people when I was 4 months sober, and I never looked back. It's one of my favorite things to do. It is the jewel of our program. Steps 10 and 11 are the juice. That's where the real juice is. Step 12 is the jewel. It is the jewel of our program. I started to go through these hearings for my court case. They offered me 3 years in prison. That's what they offered. Case keeps getting continued. My lawyer says the more time that we have for you to stay sober, the better it's going to play out. Okay, so we just need you to do your thing. So I documented everything, guys. Every time I pass a drug screen, get me a copy of it. If I had to take a breathalyzer, I need some documentation. I eventually graduated that sober living, and I got an apartment, a little studio apartment right down the street from the treatment center because I wanted to go to the meditation groups, and I became overnight staff at the treatment center. Then I got a second job, and I got back into school, and I documented all of it, and I got people to write me letters, and I would be terrified about going to prison, and I would call Dante, and I would call Randy, and they asked me, well, you should pray about it. You should go help somebody. And, you know, I remember this one time, I can't remember if it was Dante or Randy, but they said, well, use the fear prayer. God, remove my fear and direct my attention to what you would have me be. I hated when I got that piece of advice, man. I wanted something tangible that they could tell me. And this was the one that I hated the most, and Dante was the one that told me this. He said, well, if you go to prison, maybe there's somebody in there you need to carry the message to. So this is the advice I was given by these men. I stand on the shoulders of giants. Is what I do with the men I've had in my life that have taught me this way of life. And so I placed the outcome in God's hands, and some days I was riddled with fear, and other days I wasn't. But something happened, you know, close to a year later, I'm sitting in my studio apartment. I'd just gotten back from the gym. This is my buy-in moment. This is another turning point. All right, I knew my attorney had a meeting with the assistant district attorney. It was like the fourth or fifth time our case had gotten continued. And so I get a phone call and I pick it up and it's my attorney. And he says, man, I don't understand what just happened. Somebody upstairs really loves you because your charges have been dropped, dismissed, right? No paper. I didn't get on any paper. I didn't have to do any probation. Two Schedule I felonies. Drug trafficking. I'm saying that because to let you know what a miracle is when something happens in your life and you can't explain it. Right? Later on, there were some drug dealers I owed money to. I broke bread with these drug dealers. They're on my 8-step list. I had to make amends. Some of them wouldn't see me because they all thought I worked for the cops. They knew what had happened to me. You know, what am I supposed to do? Show up to like one of their houses and say, look, man, God did for me what I couldn't do for myself. Right? That doesn't fly, man. And a lot of them would never saw me, but some of them did see me. And I got some wild stories around that I'll tell later this weekend. But when I hung up the phone, something like, and I had already become like a student of the big book. So what came to me was this little paragraph. We hope these pages will prove so convincing that no further authentication will be necessary. I knew the power of God was real at this point. I didn't need any further authentication. Something happened in my life that I didn't understand. I think one of the reasons I'm so passionate about this is because of that experience. I wish I could give it to everybody. You know, but everyone has their own version of it. Somewhere on your path, you have your own version of that, right? Because when we get to the 10th step and you're asking yourself, how do I know I've entered the world of the Spirit? They don't put a sign up that says you have now entered the world of the Spirit, do they? How are you supposed to know? I think one of the ways you know, and it's sudden and profound the day it happens, right? There is no educational variety spiritual experience, guys. Now, Bill's experience I described earlier was sudden and profound, right? The day that this quits being a theory and you know deep down in your heart that God has done something for you you couldn't do for yourself, the impact is sudden and profound. The impact is sudden and profound. The impact on me that morning in my studio apartment was sudden and profound. So I made a commitment to my Creator that I was going to do this work from that day until whenever I vacate this body. Right? That's it. I made a commitment. Lindsay talked about it. This is about commitment. This is about effort. All right? But it's available. It's available to every single person sitting in this room. So I think that's all I got.
Thanks, Terry. Thank you. Hey, y'all, I'm Lindsay Alcoholic. Hey, Lindsay. This reminded me, like, when you were talking about, oh, well, maybe if you go to prison, it'll be for someone else. Y'all, I had like 2 years sober and I got my, you know, I'm sponsoring this chick. Same kind of courtship. You know, I got the letter. She's about to go to prison. And I'm talking. I'm like, oh, God is everything. You know, you're going to be fine, whatever. And I hang up. I remember being like, I don't think you're going to be okay. but you know what? Same thing happened to her. Like, just things that you wouldn't have expected. She didn't have to go to prison. But I remember, like, you know, telling her it's going to be fine. And I was like, I don't know if this is going to be fine. Like, I think she might be going back to prison. And I'm really grateful for you to go back. But so, God, that was great. Guess I'll share a little bit. I don't know. Is there anyone... So, anyone here that was like a wild child, like always been... Oh, yeah, it's just like, you just like that. That's me. Okay. I got a sister. She's a year older than me. We're opposites. I'm the, like, nightmare. She's the non-nightmare. And so I've always been just full throttle. Even, you know, I locked my hair when I was in high school. Still to this day, people are like, want to get high. And I'm like, damn, no. Like, I just attract it, you know, still. Just have a vibe, I guess, that looks like I get fucked up. So I start, you know, who else here is the come from the group of like, oh, I got drunk in middle school in my friend's parents' basement? Yes, my dogs. Okay. None of this has to do this. None of this qualifies you as an alcoholic. I'm just like, what's up? So that was me, right? I was a nightmare. Alcohol did something very powerful for me. Didn't know it. Just like I shared, I had no idea that it was going to be that profound for someone like me. But it was. So I was off. And pretty quickly, I come from a family of alcoholics. So, I mean, y'all, I was 13, 14 years old. I just gotten into high school. And I remember my mom sat me down and she was like, Lindsay, we come from a family of alcoholics. Like, you need to be careful. And I remember being like, Jesus, like, this is crazy. Like, one, I felt a little young to be intervened on already. And two, I just was like, I'm not an idiot. So why would I do that? But it was that, like, just family background. It's pretty clear. Like, we need to keep an eye out. But fortunately, you know, blew that past, and I got in a lot of trouble. I'm sure everybody gets in a lot of trouble. Doesn't really mean much. And typically, I'll spend, when I share a lot, I love, y'all heard about the allergy. That's a whole thing, right? The obsession, that's a whole thing. But what ended up happening is I had no idea I had any of that. I don't know what any of that means. Just like in Bill's story when he says, no words can tell the loneliness and despair I found on that bitter morass of self-pity. And that's like his first step, because that's like my first step. Because like no words can tell. It's like either something hits or don't hit, you know? So I think that's what's really crazy is that either someone's had this kind of like, man, no words can tell of this. We can't even articulate. And even in Bill's story, as his first step, it's not like he's like, here's when I admitted I was powerless over alcohol. My life had become a... There's none of that. It was just an experience he had where he became very clear and he was very consciously connected that he was a slave to alcohol. And one of the greatest things, similar to Tarek, that my folks did is they had this... right before I graduated high school, I got pulled over by the police for the first time doing a little drinking and driving. Wasn't very pretty. But I did the weirdest thing, y'all. Like, this was so weird when I think about it. It was the most responsible thing I'd ever done in my 18 years of being alive, and I still got caught. Anybody just, like, drink and drive, like, all the time? Like, what, are you going to be sober? You know? So I was just drink and drive all the time. And then this weird thing one night, it was real late. It might have been like 2 a.m. And I was driving, and my lights in my car, they just like all went out. Like some fuse blew or something. All went out. No lights. So I pulled into a gas station. I called my sister, woke her up. I said, Jen, you need to come get me. I'm at the Citgo. You know, it's like 4 or 5 miles away. I don't know. And pick me up because I don't have any light. She was like, yeah, I'm going to come. And she brought her boyfriend. They come, and she's like, hey. I was like, yeah, my lights don't work. She was like, cool. You want to leave your car here, ride with us? Or you want Richard to drive? You know, her boyfriend, who's now her husband, by the way, my brother-in-law. I said, no, I'll just follow you. And I got pulled over for drinking and driving. It was so dumb. Like, I had all this stuff. So I've never done that before. Never. It wasn't the drinking part where I was like, I need help. It was the part about not seeing. It was like the lights. It was like, this is bad. I could really be in trouble. And but it was crazy, you know. That was my first time, like, getting sober. I was like, I'm going to get sober. My friend that same night overdosed, so we're like, we're going to get sober together. yes. So we started getting sober, not drinking, and that was fine. And then about 3 months later, I drank again. But one of the greatest things, similar to your folks, is my parents had this, like, amazing ability to be like, nah. So when I started drinking again, they were like, we cannot do this with you anymore. So that was fine. But this is what's crazy is I had all the ups and downs and all this other kind of stuff. But this is what I think a lot of folks really do when it comes to, like, the stories or, you know, the drinking and the using and all the drama, all that happened. I did all this kind of stuff and the begging for help and then not doing it and the blah, 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 whatever. This is the craziest thing is that I really tried. I really, really, really tried to not get like that. And I really tried, really tried to get my shit together. I was the chick that was always getting her shit together. And I was the person, I tried every mixture, every component, every plan. And when my surrender experience happened, which still blows my mind to this day, because I remember even when I first met Carl, he took me through the book, he was like, well, you know, did you choose your sobriety date? And I was like, no, I didn't. Every sobriety date I chose wasn't a sobriety date. Like, never worked out. God clearly makes better choices than me. So anyways, like, it's true. It's really crazy. So this day, I was, like, dead set. I had all these plans and designs. I'll be damned if and y'all, I have totaled 3 cars. Folks in the car got injured, the whole 9 yards. I know not to do this. I always have plans on trying to get it together. So I just always think I'm good. That's a lie, by the way. So anyways, all goes down. I black out, total another car with someone in it. And this amazing thing happened. Because before all this, my folks had offered me help, friends, I've had interventions, I got kicked off the team, all this stuff. I've had all that stuff. Whatever. So the craziest thing happened is that after that wreck, I can't explain it. Every cell fiber being, because I had tried the whole, like, man, I have a drinking problem or a using problem, but I really need therapy and medication. Like, and if I can just, like, just smoke weed, whatever the case, right? I was one of those all the time. And this time, it just something hit me, and I was like, if you drink again, you're going to die or kill someone else. And I couldn't live with killing anybody else, and actually, I'll just die. But, like, I knew that was going to happen. It was bizarro. It was the first time that I was like, maybe it's actually drinking, my relationship with alcohol. Maybe it's actually that. Now, that seems like that's pretty profound experience. It was for me. Even my folks were like, I can't believe it. You did it. So I did the hospital detox, whatever. And this is the craziest part. And I'll share these few stories just because they're important. Is one, I went to my first meeting. My uncles went to AA, and even when I was getting sober, they really, growing up, they'd go to AA and drink Old Duels. My dogs. They were always like, oh, AA, it makes me want to drink more. And honestly, so, like, when I was, like, I always pictured AA as just, like, not, like, really real. You know, I just thought of my uncles drinking Old Duels, like, drinking with other people drinking Old Duels or something. So I was always like, I don't know about that. But went to my first meeting, and I had just gotten out of the hospital. I haven't been around a lot of folks. So we go to the meeting. I'm in the meeting. I get there, and then they circle up, and they start saying the Serenity Prayer or the Lord's Prayer. I actually can't remember which prayer, but they're all saying it in unison, and I just start having an anxiety attack. My heart starts pounding. My ears got red and itchy, and then I start shaking. I couldn't breathe well. And so one of the folks was like, hey, come outside. They took me outside, and I sat on a truck bed smoking Doral's. In fact, this chick was like, you smoke? I was like, well, I was in the hospital, so I haven't smoked in like 8 days. She was like, I don't think that's a good idea. I was like, you're right, give me a cigarette. And so, but this lady, this, you know, sober person, talked to me. And I remember when I told her I had 8 days, she was like, that's amazing. And I was like, yeah, I don't know. And I don't even know what we talked about. But I do know she was like, you know, I couldn't go back in the meeting because it was terrifying. You know, I was so scared to be around. I was so, like, just like, oh, my God. Because I can't remember the last time I was, like, sober, just being like, let's hang out. I didn't know how to do that. So I just, like, had an anxiety attack. And then after that, somehow some of the folks like convinced me to go out to dinner. I can't believe I went, probably because I didn't have a car. So I went out to dinner, went to this diner, and there I am again, all freaked out, you know, all these people. And this one guy was like, why don't you come over here with me? And we were sitting in this booth. And I sat in the booth with this guy, and we just talked. And he shared his experience with me. And then I went home that night at my parents' house, had to get a ride. And I cried. Alone in my bed. I don't even know why. I don't know why. And so that's like, it was, I had this really great experience. And then this is actual alcoholism in its finest, is I'm so desperate to get sober. You know, I was that chick who's like, I'll do anything, you know. Because they were like, you need to go to a sober living in Georgia, and I'm in North Carolina, but I'm like, I'll do anything. I'm so desperate. I'm a bad off. I'm so messed up. I need all the help. I want all the help. And they're like, yeah, you should do that. So we need you, you know, you should go to sober living in Georgia. And I was like, I can't do that. And they were like, well, why? And I was like, well, you know, my job. I'm in school. And friends and family. This is alcoholism more than any of the drinking. Like, leave that shit out. This is what I'm up against. And this is what I'm up against is the fact I went from that to now it's a few days later, right? And I'm sitting in front of this person telling them that I can't leave the state of North Carolina because of a job that in reality I've been fired from. I couldn't leave a school that I wasn't going to. It had been the whole semester but 1.5 classes. And friends and family who had intervened, begged, and pleaded for me to go more than once. That delusion, that is what I'm really up against. That's how insidious. I don't know what, Terry, what do you call it? The liar or the...
Yeah, the voice of the liar.
The voice of the liar. Fortunately, I was with an individual who had a gift or just a care. All this person cared to do was to just... He wasn't like, well, you don't... He was just like, oh, okay. What if we just, like, you know, the job... since it's not working out right now, maybe we just try a little stint. He just, like... kind of just questioned me gently, just kind of questioned the fact that nothing I said was true or real or accurate, even though I believed it. I really believed it, you know. And I agreed to go. I agreed to go. And I'm so grateful that I did that. Same thing. Here I am. I'm like, oh, this is bizarre because I have no idea what I'm up against because everything in me, I'm still so desperate. That's the thing. Me having alcoholism and not wanting to drink has nothing to do with me not having the mind of an alcoholic, you know? And so I'm desperate. I really do want help, but also got this thing that, man, I don't know how to receive help. And that's why, thank God, I was surrounded by people who knew how to help me do that. Right. And what does that mean? Like, I don't know how to receive help. It's because, man, I don't even know how to share what's in my mind. You know, I get to the sober living. Anybody been sober living? Dude, you gotta love that shit. Yeah. That's so annoying. The most spiritual growth happens there. Someone's like, I'm in a sober living. I'm like, tell me about the pantry. You know? Who ate the Oreos? I know it's coming, you know? I had the same thing. I've had more unhinged behavior in sober living anywhere else. So, bless you. Then this crazy thing happened because I'm desperate as all get out. I'm in the sober living. I'm doing the IOP. And I care, y'all. I'm, like, super interested. I'm super desperate. I want help, but I also have stuff going on with me that I don't know what it is, but it's a lot of what Tarek said, some spring inside of me, you know, and I was so scared to tell folks that everything in me wants to not drink, but everything in me does. I didn't know how to say it. I was going to get kicked out of AA land. You know, they'd be like, we can't come back here. You don't care because you want to drink. I didn't hear anybody talking about it. I was so scared because I had all these people, like, really helping me. They're like, Vince, you're doing great. You know, stick with the winners. You know, all this good stuff. And I appreciated it, but also, y'all, everyone, like, kind of annoyed me. So it's like this awkward thing where I'm like, I'm so glad they're helping me, but I'm also like, God, shut the fuck up. You know? And I don't know what's, it's a little complicated. And I didn't know how to do anything with that. And it was, and this is why I'm like, I talk about all this stuff as much as I can, because no one, like, I didn't hear a lot of it. This could have been happening too. But, fortunately, something happened. It's actually a counselor, one of the like IOP counselors, came to me, and I was like, "Of course, I'm in sober living. You know who I'm hanging out with? My people, the ones who, you know what I mean? Like, I'm new, so I'm like, oh, you kind of fucked up, okay? You know, but like, I'm also participating at a high level in IOP. Like, I'm doing the best I can, but I'm scared. Like, I'm scared. People with sober people scare me." You know, I was just scared. And, but she was like, you keep hanging out with these fools, you're going to get high. And y'all, I knew she was right. I just, like, something in me was just like, God, because guess what? The sober people, they were, like, doing things, like going out to dinner after the meeting and, like, hanging out on, you know, doing activities. And I was like, I'm tired. Like, I don't want to do activities. And then, I don't know, but something in me was like, shit, I gotta do that. And so something bubbled up in me, and y'all, something I just exploded one day, and this counselor was like, you need to talk to this guy named Carl. He's like you. And I was like, that guy? Like me? He's not like me. But that's the first time that someone articulated and put language on how I felt and how I drank. I don't know if I ever met anybody that drank like that or felt like that. Like, actually, like, really meet. I'm not talking about when you're partying. You know, I'm talking about, like, when you're trying, like, when you're sober, newly getting sober. And the little tricky things, like, the little tricky things that you do or you think. Like, he said them, and I was like, oh, weird, I do that too. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, just, like, weird stuff where I'm like, oh, I gotta, like, drink like this and then take this like this, and then I make sure. You know, I got, like, a whole thing going. And he said all of that, and he just shared something I'd never heard, and then he started taking me through the book. And I am one of those. I'm a squish. I'm the person that I would read the read parts out of the big book, and I cried in that sober living at night by myself. I felt safer at sober living than I did at my parents' house. I think it might have been the first time in my entire life that, like, there was a possibility. There was just the first possibility that I might be okay. And that guy Carl is the first person to disturb me on the question of alcoholism. Because when I told him that I was desperate and I would never drink again, he said, I promise you will. And I said, damn, that's cold and harsh, and you're wrong. And he's like, let's look at your experience. And I looked at my experience, and then I really, it was so true. It wasn't, there's many times that I wanted to and that I needed to. And I drank again. So what I saw was that, oh my God, even though I want to and I need to, what I'm up again has nothing to do with that. That I'm going to need to have an experience with something greater than myself. Because I really did believe the reason I wasn't successful before is because I didn't care enough. Then if I cared more this time, then that means I'm going to be successful this time. And he was like, oh no, it just means like you're going to have to have a spiritual awakening and a psychic change. And so he told me to pray, and I prayed under my covers at the sober living because I'm not a loser. So I'm dead ass. I was like, it's a little weird, you know, like, well, gay chick from the South is like, oh, but I am one of those too, to be, you know, just like, real honest, that kind of stuff started to change the trajectory of my life, and I am one of those. The God thing, I don't know. I just didn't care. I just knew I believed in alcoholism, period. I just believed from my experience that I would drink again, whether I wanted to or not. So that was my first experience with a power greater than myself, with any sort of conception, was believing in that. Just started prayer, you know. It just started me reading, meeting with Carl, and that just started it. Was me just believing in alcoholism. And, of course, obviously, it's definitely changed and, you know, grown over time. But what I have found that is, and that's why I guess what's so funny is that we talk a lot about all the allergy or the upset, you know, all this other kind of stuff. But at the end of the day, how the mind works and all the lies that we believe, because even when I can't differentiate truth from the false when it comes to a drink or the drug, right? I can't, right? So I can't be in reality. There's only two times I've been in it. So what happens when I do take a drink, you know, that first spiritual awakening, you know, that was pretty powerful. But the only time I've been in reality is when I saw that I couldn't safely take one and that I would drink it again. And I had no choice. That was a reality for me. First experience of like present or like that kind of awakening. And what's really nuts is that a majority of like my recovery is just a continual series of surrenders and continuing to wake up to lies that I thought were true that were not. And what a powerful, and that's like such a big, the continual teaching experience for me. You know, I mean, shit, even at 5 years, I remember I believed for 5 years, or my whole life, not my whole life, but a long time, that my sister was ashamed of me because I was gay. And I believe that, so our relationship was fractured. I mean, the drinking doesn't have much to do with it, right? that had a huge part. But even once I got sober, this was sober. I still believed this. And then I was crazy. Did some inventory, looked at it. I believed that for so long, and it put distance in between us. 5 years sober, I made amends to her for that, and she just started crying, and she said, all I've ever wanted was to be close with you. And just like that, that all dropped. And I talked to my sister all the time. We're close as can be. We love each other. We support each other. But for many, many years, we were not because of anything other than something I believed that wasn't true. And I didn't know how to investigate it. And I didn't know how to question it or see it. Same thing that gentleman did for me when I believed that I couldn't go to Georgia because I was employed and, you know, all this other stuff. The same thing, just questioning, like, can we even just hold space to see that maybe there's something else and you can have a new experience with it. So I hope that happens for everybody. Thanks for letting me share.
Thank you. Thank you.